This is Audible.
Listening Library presents Flamefall by Rosaria Munda. Read for you by Christian Coulson, Candice Moll, and Aidan Kelly.
1. New Pythos. Griff. Julia's missing, and I'm in a terrible mood. Not improved by the weather, which is cold and damp. But in New Pythos, it's always cold and damp. I'm gutting fish in a back room off the dragon lairs when Scully comes to find me.
Dragon Lord here to see you, the lair master says.
That's the one way to make my day worse. Bran and Fiona, the other two squires on fish gutting duty, exchange a look. We're up to our arms in bits of fishbone and scales. The stink of the fish oil will follow us out of the lairs. And now I'm going to miss the one perk that comes with prepping dragon feed, sneaking the remains home. I rise, wiping my hands on the work rag. Scully hates the sound of my perfect dragon tongue, which is why I always try to use it. Which dragon lord? I pause just long enough for him to wonder if I'll add, Sir. Scully scowls. This is why he keeps putting me on fish gutting. Lip. Not to mention our clans hate each other.
The one you serve, he says in Norrish.
Most days that would be good news. Today I just wish it were Julia. On the balustrade outside, Dilo Skyfish waits for me. I remember as a child being struck by the Calipolan exiles when they arrived on New Pythos, at the ghostly pallor of the Storm Scourge survivors, at the warm brown skin and tight curls of the Skyfish Lords. Dilo Skyfish no longer looks like the ragged urchin that washed ashore 10 years ago, but he's still striking. And at the sight of his fur cloak and freshly coiffed hair, I'm conscious of my own stinking state. I bow low. Your presence is an unexpected honor, my lord. Dilo mutters, as you were. I straighten. Dilo is scowling at me, like he knows I'm trying to discomfort him. He's my age, taller than I, but slenderer. The Triarchian exile wants to speak with you. I hug my arms around my chest, shivering from the sea spray coming in off the water. We're dwarfed by the cliffs above and the citadel atop them, and by the limestone pillars of karst that jut from the sea into the sky. Did they tell you what for? I use the formal you, and when Dilo answers, he uses the informal. When we were younger, and I was still figuring out dragon tongue, he tried to get me to use the informal too, or speak to him in Norrish, which he was learning at the same time, but I refused. In trials of will with Dilo, I win. They want to question you about Julia, he says. She's missing. As if I haven't noticed. Why would I know where Julia is? Dilo hesitates. Ixion told them. From the way he says it, I don't have to ask what. The last time I saw Julia, her lips were on mine. In the dark, I could feel, not see, her smile as she bunched my shirt to raise it. She always smiles, like what we're doing is a game, and it amuses her to win. Ixion told them. I've stopped walking, and Dilo stops too, turning back to me. His face says everything I need to know about what's about to happen in the glass hall. He doesn't say, I'm sorry, and I don't say, Ixion had no right. By now, I'm no stranger to the humiliations Ixion devises. Like being called before the glass hall as Julia's peasant lover, stinking of fish. As if he'd heard me think it, Dilo reaches into his satchel. I brought you a fresh shirt. Most of Dilo's clothes are blue, the color of his house, but this shirt is plain, undyed, appropriate for a peasant. Even so, it's finer than anything I've ever owned, and I'm likely to ruin it with muck. I pull it over my head, and when I look up, Dilo's watching me. He looks away, down. The shirt smells like him. I follow Dilo up the winding outer stairs, carved into the side of the cliff, and looking out over the North Sea that connect the layers where I work to the citadel at the summit. Both were built by the Haerelians in the original conquering, when they invaded Norcia with their dragons, subjugated my people, and renamed our island New Pythos. The dragons' bloodlines dried up in the cold not long after, but the lords remained. And now, for the first time in generations, they have dragons again. 25 dragons, brought as eggs by the Kallipolan exiles 10 years ago. Dragons for revenge. Dragons for the exiles' surviving sons. Dragons for the sons of the lords on whose hospitality they imposed. Titles for their children in a future greater Kallipolis. But there weren't enough sons. The exiled triarchy was forced to present the remaining hatchlings to others. Female dragonborn, like Julia. Bastards who trickled in from Kallipolis's vassal islands, once despised for their illegitimacy, but now needed. Dragons were still unclaimed. So with a fleet not yet filled, the dragonborn resorted to a measure few believed would work. They had the remaining dragons presented to the sons and daughters of their Norcian serfs. And the dragons chose. They call us Humble Riders. Dilo and I enter the glass hall, and in the moment it takes to draw in a breath, I'm able to observe the room. A great expanse of rippled glass windows look out over the karst pillars rising from the North Sea, and the combined dragonborn courts of my Haerelian rulers and the Kallipolan exiles surround us in a ring of stiff-armed chairs. In the center sits Rhadamanthus Haerelian, the great lord of New Pythos, who also assumed the vacant title of Aurelian Triarch after the revolution. No Aurelians from Kallipolis survived to contest it. Three chairs to the edge of the ring seat, the highest-ranked dragon riders of the three families. Ixion Stormscourge, Rode Haerelian, and, the seat is empty, waiting for him, Dilo. The three triarchs presumptive. When Kallipolis is regained and reunited with New Pythos, they will share the triple throne. I kneel, place my palms flat on the floor, and stare at the stone between them. Dilo says, I present to the glass hall my squire, Griff Garrison of Clan Nag, humble rider for the Pythian fleet. He remains by my side, leaving the waiting chair beside Ixion empty. Welcome, Griff. I don't have to see the man speaking to picture him. Rhadamanthus is a bear of a man, his auburn hair graying, his golden skin lined. Ixion informs us you might have privileged information about Julia. Rhadamanthus is known in the clans for being a hard man, but I have found, compared with the whims of the Kallipolan exiles and their dragons, his rule measured, if harsh. I keep my eyes trained on the flagstones between my hands. I'm afraid Lord Ixion is mistaken, Your Grace. Lady Julia has never treated me as her confidant. Ixion snorts. Rhadamanthus's son, Rode, who does everything Ixion does, snorts too. Lady Electra's voice comes crisp with disdain. She is Ixion and Julia's great aunt, a Storm Scourge widow since before the revolution, and the choice to draft Norcian dragon riders has always sat poorly with her. I always find it unnerving when they speak dragon tongue too well. Dilo shifts weight in his boots beside me. I ask my hands, would my lady prefer that I speak Gnorish? No, thank you. This is a waste of time, Rhadamanthus. I don't believe him. Ixion's voice cuts through the adults. Cold, frayed, like the very words he says bore him even as he speaks. This many years into training with him, his voice alone has the power to make me break into a cold sweat. I know to associate Ixion's voice with certain things. Pain, fear, and humiliation.
Rack your brains, Griff. See if she didn't let something slip while she was rotting with you.
Ixion, says Rhadamanthus sharply.
Rhode has caught Ixion's drift and decides to play too.
How's Aga? He asks. Maybe she'd help you remember. We can have her brought in with her brats.
I watch my fingers, splayed on the stone, curl beneath themselves. I wait for someone to say, that won't be necessary. But no one does. They only took on Norsian riders who have families. Ixion and Rhode figured out why early on. They learned my sister's name fast. Dilo's voice comes from close, lowered, bracing.
Griff, think. Anything from Julia that seemed a little off. Off. Julia's always been so unpredictable. Off seems like a meaningless word to use about her. But then I remember something.
She was writing a letter recently.
And?
Julia's half-dressed form, curled over her writing desk, her long hair let down for the night. I remember noticing at the time how her nightrobe had fallen from one shoulder to reveal a sloping angle of bare, burn-scarred skin. At the sound of my tread, she jumped and turned, one arm flattening over the letter behind her. But when she saw me, it relaxed. Oh, only you. Come here. She didn't want anyone to see it.
Rhadamanthus's chair creaks as he leans forward. But you saw it. Did you see to whom it was addressed? Its contents?
I did see it. I could see it from her bed. She left it lying unfolded atop her writing desk when she pulled me onto her mattress. Open, every word exposed to my eyes. This letter she didn't want anyone to see. I am gripping the stone. The explanation thick on my tongue, though it has no reason to be. I wait for someone else to remember it, but absurdly they don't. As if I speak dragon tongue too well for them to remember to associate the laws their people enforce on mine with me. Dilo beside me shifts, as if he understands. But Ixion beats him to it. He sounds torn between amusement and irritation.
Griff can't read.
Lord Nestor speaks for the first time.
This is pointless, Rhadamanthus. I told you it would be a waste of time to question the boy.
Nestor is Dilo's father and our drill master. Strict with his riders in the air, and stricter on the ground. He is a sky widower, a rider who lost his dragon. Dilo says it's a loss you never recover from, and the cause of his father's foul temper. I'm pretty sure Nestor would have his temper toward me either way. I force the words out through anger. She seemed agitated. Afterward, she talked about family. And loyalty. Julia's fingers in my hair, absently pulling curls straight, our bodies wound together beneath blankets softer than any my family has ever seen. Would you always love your sister, even if she betrayed you? What would you do if she betrayed you? The strange, unexpected dampness on my shoulder, so unusual I did not realize at once what it meant. That Julia was crying. Rhadamanthus drums fingers on the arm of his chair.
You're suggesting she was writing Leo, the cousin who rides for the usurper. We forbade her contacting him after his last refusal.
Dilo speaks, his voice a murmur, as if he's realizing as he speaks. But when has Julia ever listened, when something was forbidden her? Silence meets his words, as if the others weigh Dilo's point, and all the while I kneel in front of them, proof of it. Ixion's cold voice trickles over me, breaking the silence.
Didn't see fit to report any of this earlier, did you, Griff?
I lift my head and look at him. Ixion's face is an elongated, lined version of Julia's. The same jet-black hair, the blazing eyes set in a pale face, the same thin mouth prone to laughter. But where Julia's laughter can be cruel for being uncaring, Ixion's is just cruel. Don't say it. But then I do. I did not think it my place to share the First Rider's business with her alterness. For a moment, the only sounds are of the gulls, whose cries come muffled through the windows, and the echoing of my own stupid, reckless words in the glass-walled room. Ixion leaps to his feet, his mantle rippling.
Garrison should be flogged for his tone.
Though I should feel fear, all I feel is fury. Do it, Ixion. Settle it on the ground, the only place you'll ever be able to beat me. Beside me, Dilo takes a half step forward, between Ixion and myself. Another mistake. The last thing Nesta needs is further reason to suspect that his son has grown soft towards his inferiors.
Enough, Rhadamanthus says. We're wasting time. We need to deploy search parties south.
I wasn't always Dilo's squire. In the beginning, I was Ixion's. Ixion was imaginative in his cruelty. Do you want to know where I learned this? He would ask. The answer was always the same, even when it couldn't be true.
Palace Day, from peasants like you on Palace Day.
By the time Julia and Dilo found out and told Dilo's father, the abuse had escalated to the point that injuries interfered with my riding. Nestor Skyfish doesn't care much about Humble Rider's well-being, but he does care about the well-being of the fleet. I was transferred to Dilo. Ixion was deemed unfit to be served by a squire. Ixion never forgave either of us for it. Outside the glass hall, Dilo and I make our way to the exile's extension of the citadel known as the Provisional Palace. Each of the three families has their own armory, with an interior entrance to the lairs.
That was rash, Dilo murmurs when he sees that the Skyfish armory is deserted and we're alone. You shouldn't have pulled rank on him like that.
I can't pull rank on him. I'm not ranked. Humble Riders didn't participate in the First Rider tournament. Dilo lifts an eyebrow, like he knows I'm just being stupid on purpose.
Julia isn't here to protect you, he says. You think I don't know that?
Our gear hangs on hooks along the stone wall. I fetch Dilo's armor while he shrugs on his flame suit. His armor has been polished recently by me. The Skyfish lilies are shining in their crest. I've served as Dilo's squire for years now, but the one thing that's become less, not more, comfortable over the years is arming him. He holds his breath. I talk a lot.
What was he like?
I ask as I work my way down his side, clasping buckles and tightening straps.
Leo,
you must have known him before. Dilo is staring fixedly at the wall past me. I always thought, he says, and pain enters his voice, that Leo had a good heart. But I thought that about Ixion too, before Palace Day. When he's armed, I step away from him and he unfreezes. I hasten into my own flame suit, a cast-off from Dilo, tight in the shoulder, long in the leg, but serviceable. Then I gather our gear before following Dilo down the spiral stairs to the lairs, carved into the rock and lit by narrow windows that face out over the sea. Our dragons are stabled side by side, and Dilo always makes a point, though he clucks a greeting to his Skyfish Japhira as he passes her, of accompanying me to Sparker first. Sparker, like all the dragons ridden by Norseans, is chained and muzzled. The muzzle is a safety measure. It was a precaution put in place when we sparked. I'd be flattered if it didn't make me and Sparker so miserable. The muzzle doesn't come off, but the chain does, and Dilo keeps the key. I'm used to it, Lords know I've had years to get used to it, but even so, the sight of Sparker straining against that muzzle, choking himself with the collar as he strains to reach me, never stops hurting. And as if D'Lo knows it, he always blocks the sight from me. Unchains Sparker with quiet cluckings to calm him, and then jumps out of the way as Sparker bounds toward me. Sparker's a storm scourge, my storm scourge, black as the night, oversized and overspirited, and when I embrace him, he leans into it so hard he nearly bowls me over. His wingspan, pride of the aerial fleet, is already so large that when he twitches his wings open, they beat the stone walls on either side of us. "Missed you too," I murmur. He growls, the most his muzzle permits him to do, and I hold him tighter and wish for the thousandth time I could tear the damned thing off. They keep it loose enough in the jaws so he can eat, but not breathe fire. I reach up, rub where it chafes, and he lets out the smallest pleading grunt that makes everything inside me ache. I know. I've thought more than once how it would have been easier for everyone, Sparker, me, and the Triarchy included, if he'd chosen a different rider. A Dragonborn rather than a Norsian. Then I would have lived the peasant life I was born to, fishing like my father on Hay Aurelian Charter, lost in an untimely storm on the North Sea. Sparker wouldn't have been muzzled or chained. But Sparker never seems to blame me, and for all the ways it makes my daily life hell, I've never felt anything but pride at the fact that Sparker is mine, and I'm his. Most of the Dragonborn hold it against us both. D'Lo is watching us, something stirring in his eyes, but when I meet them, he looks away. I saddle Sparker in silence, take up my pike and shield, and follow D'Lo's lead as we launch out the layer mouth and take to the air over the crashing waves. We turn south in search of Julia.
2. First Rider and Alternus. Lee. It's been 5 hours since I killed my cousin. In the infirmary ward, there are visitors. Chrissa, Cor, Annie, briefly, her face haloed in light from the door. There are medicines for pain and medicines for sleep. And then I am alone, and I am somewhere else. 6. Julia and I are playing in the palace gardens. Our fathers are dragon lords. The world is before us. We are certain that one day we will be great like them. When we laugh, we do it until our sides hurt. When we shout, we do it for the world to hear. And when we pretend to kill and pretend to die, it's thrilling and glorious and fun. 7. We are in my family's parlor and I am watching blood seep across the rug. The parlor has narrowed to spaces I can look and spaces I can't. So much screaming that I've stopped hearing it. Someone says in a language I barely know, "Don't look away. Watch. Watch them get what they deserve." My last sister has stopped struggling. A knife glints, lowers. My father's pleas dissolve. My father on his knees before Atreus saying, "Please, my son." 8. The orphanage is always cold. A red-haired girl too small to fight is fighting children twice her size. I move between them. I learn the girl's name. Annie. 9. I stand in a square and watch my father's dragon lose its head. I stand in the yard and hear Annie say it. "That dragon killed my family." 10. A dragon looks me in the eye and chooses me. Atreus looks me in the eye and sees a low-born orphan. Annie looks me in the eye and keeps the secrets we have learned to hold between us. Forward, forward, forward. Happiness of sorts, the kind that comes with racing toward the future, with forgetting. Until 17. Wings on the horizon, my family returned from the dead, a forsaken hope risen with them. My cousin Julia smiling across the booth of a darkened pub as she tells me I look like my mother, and that she's missed me. Annie standing in front of a ruined home, dropping to her knees to demonstrate how a serf kneels before their lord to ask for mercy. Her fingers tracing the path of my father's dragonfire. Julia Sur Erinys in the air. Palor and I against them. Fire. Julia's helmet at my feet on Pytho's keep. Atreus laying his hand on my forehead as if to absolve me of my blood, my past, my crime. Rise, son of Callipolis. Lee? The sun has set, but even in the darkness I know the silhouette over me is Annie's. I know the touch of her hand on my face, the smell of her breath warm and close. The sounds I don't know, someone weeping. And then I swallow and the sounds stop. Annie folds the bed linens back and curls into bed beside me. It feels like someone else speaks with my mouth. I came back to you. My voice sounds foreign in my own ears, thick and strained, like my tongue is drunken. I hear her, feel her swallow. I know. I knew you would. Her arms are around me the way I used to hold her. Annie, the body. Her thumbs press under my eyes, wipe outward. I'm going to return her. They said you could? Annie is silent for a moment, then with an edge of steel. Don't worry about that. Didn't know you were such a rule breaker. She sniffs, something like a snort. Her lips touch my forehead. You don't know the half of it. There are fewer nightmares after that. The smell of her, the warmth of her, like an anchor when I start to drift too far. When I can't remember why I did what I did. When I can't trace the steps that led me to become someone who killed their kin. Her lips on mine, tentative like she's asking me to remember something. We're monsters, even if they call us something different. I taste her lips, taste her tongue, taste her mouth like I seek to drown. I did it for this, for you, Annie, warm in my arms. Is it enough? Can it ever be enough? Worth the breach when Erinys screeched the loss of Julia? Pre-dawn light cracks through the infirmary curtains when she stirs beside me. It's time. I should do it now. Lee, there's something. There's something I need to tell you before I go. She extricates herself from my arms, enough that there is space between us. Helps me sit upright. Movement, even slight and careful, burns like new fire. Her hands are twisted together, her face close, her rumpled red-brown hair soft around her face, flattened on one side from the pillow. Atreus was there with his guard because he didn't intend for you to come back from Pytho's keep. While I'm staring at her, trying to make sense of why she would think this, or what it matters or means, she starts talking again. She starts talking about Palace Day. She has to say it twice for me to understand her. Atreus didn't save you on Palace Day. No, he did. He said, What language was he speaking when he gave that soldier the order, Lee? She is staring at me, waiting for me to say it. Kalish. The language I barely spoke before she taught it to me. I fight the rising panic with the part I do remember, because it was in dragon tongue. But before that, my father asked. He told my father. Annie's eyes are filling with tears. I stare back into her buckling face and intuit what she is thinking, remembering, what she can't bring herself to say. That empty words are given to comfort dying men. I pull my hands out of hers. If Atreus didn't want me to come back from the duel, I tell her, and I tell myself that this is ridiculous, that I know it's ridiculous even as I hear my voice shake, then why were there witnesses? Annie's fingers twist on her lap. I brought the witnesses, she whispers. I defied orders to bring the witnesses. For a moment, the only sound is the palace clock tower, tolling the quarter hour. Rise, son of Gallipolis. Annie's liquid eyes wide, watching me, waiting. And then there's the sound of my own breathing as I fight for air. Annie reaches for my hands again, and I snatch them back. Lee, I killed Julia for a man who wanted me dead. You didn't do it for him. The words trip a wire that snaps, and I let out a burst of laughter that sounds nothing like myself. Because I did it for you? My voice is so loud it echoes on the whitewashed walls. Annie flinches. I slow my words. Did you know? Annie's voice cracks. No. I didn't know when Atreus asked me if you would. I only realized after. Atreus asked you if I would? Annie blanches, freezes, like she's taken one step too far onto ice, and then inhales a shuddering breath like she's realized she can't stop now. He asked me if I thought you'd do it, she whispers, and I said you would. Because you knew I'd come back to you. She recoils at the echo of her own words like a slap. Suddenly, looking at her, what had been desire shifts. My cousin, my kin, blood on my hands. A duel I was sent to like a sacrifice. My father lost to me in every way possible to lose someone you love. And now Atreus lost too. And all of it, all that suffering, embodied in this scrawny girl, this mess of brown hair and freckles, this serf, who has asked and asked and asked of me until she has left me with nothing and still expects me to come back to her. Lee? Annie's withdrawing slowly, the way she'd back away from an inhaling dragon. I can feel it building, fire at the back of my throat, a pressure. The words come out stiff and halting. I think you should go. As she rises, her face half afraid, all I can feel as I see that fear is satisfaction. I'm going to return Julia's body, she says. Does she expect me to thank her? At the thought, at the bloody absurdity of it, I feel a smile spread across my face like it belongs to someone else. She sees my smile and her face crumples. The words tumble out as they break. I'm so sorry, Lee. Get out.
Annie. It's been less than a day since Lee Sir Palor named me first rider and fleet commander of Gallipolis. Hours since he killed his cousin and childhood friend in a duel to prove his loyalty to the regime that killed his family. 8 years since he learned his father killed mine. 9 years since we became friends. 10 minutes since he withdrew his hands from mine and bared teeth at me in a way that made the hair on the back of my neck stand on end. His body is a cage, I tell myself, and he's trapped in it. I leave the ward with the smell of Julia's dragon fire lingering in my nostrils. I push the image of Lee's vacant smile from my vision. I push the thought of my own guilt, my responsibility for this boy's suffering, from my head. I don't have the luxury of being distracted by guilt or pain or sadness. I focus on what I can control. I don't have permission exactly. When I asked General Holmes about returning Julia's body, he told me the matter needed to be considered carefully first. We don't have time for that. It's the second day. And I intend to return it before a dignified return is not possible. I'll deal with Holmes on the other side. I will need backup to return her body. I let my mind cycle through the list of candidates as I make my way through the quiet palace. Lee recused himself, naming me first rider and fleet commander, placing Ayla and me at the forefront of a war against the dragon lords who once incinerated my home. Lee may not have been ready to lead this war, but I am. Returning Julia's body will not just be a favor to Lee. It will be an opportunity for New Pythos to learn my name. Backup. It should be a skilled rider. Someone from the 4th or at least the 8th Order, who could have my back if the mission gets hot. They should have sufficient fluency in dragon tongue to be an asset rather than a handicap. And because this is one of my first selections as permanent first rider, it should be a choice that broadens rather than concentrates the reach of my authority in the Guardian Corps. There was a time when the cloister bustled with guardians eating and studying and arguing in the solarium. That was before the threat from New Pythos. Now those who aren't sleeping off a night shift are on patrol along the northern coast, and those who aren't on patrol are supervising ration distribution in the city. I suit up in a deserted armory and make my way down to the dragon's caves. Ayla is in Palor's nest, curled at his side as if Lee's distress had leaked down through the stones into his dragon, and she seeks to comfort him. I cluck to her and she launches to her feet, wings snapping open, tail twitching. Palor's nostrils flare at my intrusion. The silver of his scales glows in the darkness of the torchlight, Ayla's amber tone a warm glow. I have to stand high on my toes to throw the saddle over her back and lengthen the girth another notch to fit it under her wing joints. You're getting too big for me. With her and Palor nearly full grown and both sparked, I wonder, as I've begun to wonder whenever I find them together like this, when she'll begin to lay. Eggs, more dragons, a future for Kallipolis. Ayla lets out a snort of satisfaction, smoke puffing from her nostrils, and crouches obligingly for me to hook a boot in her stirrup and swing into the saddle. She'll be back, I tell Palor. Ayla's wings unfurl like sails as she kicks off. The feeling of the ground falling away fills me with a familiar relief. I've long since stopped being able to distinguish it as Ayla's or my own. We glide down the cave corridor in near darkness, up through the fire-mouth chasm that pierces the center of the inner palace, and finally burst into daylight above. The palace, the arena, the cast of Pytho's keep, and the city radiating from it shrink to map size below us as we rise. An autumn breeze blows fresh on my face, and I fill my lungs with it. Minutes later, Ayla lands on the opposite side of the river in the central square of Southside, where ration cards are being distributed by the city guard. Power Sir Eater and Rock Sir Bast are the two guardians on monitoring duty. It's not a popular assignment. Citizens have started noticing that rationing is unequal among class metals, and tension riddles the square as people eye one another's wristbands. Despite the sour looks of citizens waiting in the queue, Power manages to look bored. He lounges at the booth while his dragon circles at a safe distance above, alongside Rock's. Rock looks less at ease, every muscle of his hulking body tensed. I dismount and pat Ayla's flank, sending her back into the air where she joins Eta and Bast. A flash of Aurelian red alongside their black, their thick storm scourge bodies and broad wings dwarfing her by comparison. Rock squints at me.
How's?
He stutters to a halt and goes a brilliant red. Of all of us, Rock has taken the news of Lee's Dragonborn identity hardest. I can't blame him. Rock and I are both Highlanders and former serfs of Stormscourge House. But I had years to adjust to the idea that I was friends with the son of people who hurt my family. Rock's had little more than a week. I try to think of an answer and feel my eyes prickle. How is Lee? So hurt he just turned on me like a feral dog. He's been better.
Do you think he'd want visitors?
Suddenly, I could hug Rock. I restrict myself to nodding. Soon. I think he could really use that. Rock nods, avoiding my eyes. In normal circumstances, Rock, gentle and giant where power is lithe, unpredictable and cruel, would be my choice of mission partner without thought. But returning the dead cousin of your best friend to your former lords is not normal circumstances. I turn to Power. My backup, a native speaker of Dragon Tongue, a member of the Fourth Order, with skills in the air to match mine, and, most recently, single-handedly responsible for trying to get Lee arrested and spreading rumors that cast doubt on my fitness to lead. It's time to change that. Power has a boot propped on one knee, as if ration supervision were a spectator sport. Commander? I place a map of the North Sea and a copy of the ancient Dragon Tongue epic, The Aurelian Cycle, on the table between us. I'm going to pull a Book 24. Book 24, where Uriel returns the body of his enemy's fallen son across enemy lines. Rock looks bewildered, but Power only lifts an eyebrow. Guardians raised on the Janiculum know their Dragonborn poetry. Ambitious, Power says, even for you. I'm looking for a rider to come with me. Rock's mouth has actually slipped open. After all, he spent the last 7 years fielding the same birth-based insults from Power as I have. Power's smile begins. Just one? Yeah, just one. If they're good enough. With a flick of an invisible speck from the table, Power slides to his feet. At the far end of the booth, an iron woman receiving her ration card from the city guard begins to argue, her shrill voice rising as she points at the bronze family who went before her. Class Iron's father down the queue are looking over. Not since the famine of my childhood have I seen such wild eyes. Iron receives less than bronze. Bronze less than silver. Silver less than gold. As dictated by the state when they had to decide with starvation inevitable, which populations were of greatest value and which would endure the greatest losses. These are the inequalities that have begun to define every second I spend on foot in the city. Power flashes a grin at Rock as he lifts his silver and gold wristband to his lips to blow into its summoning whistle. Do Kallipolis proud, Richard. Above us, Eta and Ayla fold their wings into a dive. Julia's body lies shrouded on a table in the palace infirmary, in an unheated room chill with the autumn cold. Overcome with sudden hesitation, I pause at the threshold. Power is the one who approaches the table, and with surprising care, rolls back the wrappings hiding her face. She looks like Lee. The same long, pale face, the same dark hair. Where's her helmet? I ask. She should be wearing it. Power looks around the room and points at the pile of discarded gear Lee returned. It's caked with soot and dragon's blood. We should wash it. Yeah, and her armor. Power's usual hatred for the Dragonborn seems stilled in the presence of the dead. The next half hour is spent in almost complete silence as we work. I wonder if he, like me, is remembering other burials. We both know how to prepare a body. When we're done, he lifts Julia as gently into his arms as if she were sleeping, and carries her out into the courtyard off the palace infirmary where our dragons wait. Ayla greets me with a subdued nuzzle to my palm, while Power secures the added load to Eta's side. Even the dragons are quiet, as if they sense the gravity of what we're about to do. We take the dragons along the usual flight path north. When we reach the coast, we leave the patrol route behind. My knowledge of the North Sea is piecemeal, but its extensive karst outcroppings, especially as we veer east toward New Pythos, are sufficient to navigate from the maps we've studied ever since the Pythian threat reared its head. How much of the Aurelian cycle do you have memorized? I ask Power as the Kallipolin coast shrinks behind us. Wing to wing, Ayla and Eta fly about 30 feet apart, shouting distance. Power's patrician credentials include a childhood of dragon tongue tutors he delights in complaining about. Too much. Good. Drill me. We race across the North Sea as I shout the dragon tongue that I intend to say, and Power corrects me till I know the line's called. Finally, we see what we've been waiting for. A patrol pair, dragons like ours, coming toward us, their armor the gleaming white of New Pythos. A skyfish so pale it looks more silver than blue, with long wings all the slenderer compared with the great storm scourge at its side. The first of the Pythian fleet I've ever seen at signing distance. I wave the Pali flag, and we descend for Wayfarer's Arch.
3. The Body. Griff. I've cursed most of this life on New Pythos, squiring included. But the one thing I'd never curse, would never be able to experience except with sheer mad joy, is flying. What's it like, my sister Aga always asks. Describe it to me. I try to put words to it. The way the North Sea becomes layers of silver, fog rolling off the waves. The way you feel the light flood your veins, like dragon fire. The way it feels to weave through the forest of karst pillars that rise from the sea around New Pythos in all their jagged splendor. The karst forest that surrounds New Pythos is called Sailor's Folly. Sailor's Folly dragon's delight. The five castes nearest New Pythos, surrounding it on all sides, are the Norsian clan castes. There's no joy like surfing the wind through the clan castes on the back of a dragon, circling the sheer walls of turret, racing over little humpbacked gnoll, winding through kraken's bony arms, skimming over shaggy thorn rows with her sprawling vines. Best of all is the nag, my own clan caste, her nose deep in the water, the standing stones of her shrine on her crown, and the arch beneath her chin just wide enough for a dragon's wingspan to pass through. These are my people's stones, and when I'm coursing between them on Sparker's back, I don't feel cursed. I feel like the luckiest Norsian in the world. That's what I try to describe to my sister when she asks. I try not to talk about how it feels to see their Heorelian minds defiling the bases of our clan castes and hollowing out their insides, the little squares of barges below ferrying ore back to the main harbour. They make Norsians do the mining for their meagre trade. Since the war with Kallipolis was declared, fewer traders than ever dare deal with New Pythos. But even before that, it was only the boldest who dared make the passage through Sailor's Folly. As the search party pairs fan out, heading south toward Kallipolis, Japhira nips at Sparker's side, and the two dragons begin their dance. Though I ride a storm scourge, I've never regretted being transferred into the service of a skyfish. They use speed where we use force, and even if it's not the usual combination, it's long since become a rhythm we understand. Where flying with Julia has always been a battle, a thrilling battle, a contest of great wills, this is easy. This is home. Japhira urges Sparker faster, lower to the waves, in a race we'll never win but love to join in as we weave our way out of the pillars at the periphery of Sailor's Folly. It's dusk, and the sky is filling with light, the fog breaking into ragged clouds, the castes lit with gold. In the air, for the first time since Julia disappeared, I feel the weight on my chest lift like it's been blown away in the sea wind. And then I see them. Two riders who aren't ours. An Aurelian and a Storm Scourge approaching. Their riders wear the red armor of the Revolutionary Fleet. We slow at the sight of them. The Storm Scourge is bearing a load. A body-shaped load. The Aurelian rider waves a white flag. In the sunset, it glows orange. Dilo signals with an arm to the nearest cast, jutting from the ocean. It's Wayfarer's Arch. The dragon perch on which Julia met Leo a month ago. The four of us descend. All the while, I can't tear my eyes from that swathed load, strapped to the side of the storm skirt. The two pairs dismount and approach one another, leaving our dragons on opposite ends of the platform. The Kallipolans are wearing the revolutionary crest of the dragon-breathing circlets of fire. The Storm Scourge rider is tall, the Aurelian rider shorter, slighter. When they remove their helmets, I realize the Aurelian rider is a girl. A girl with cropped brown hair that glows red in the sunset, and eyes that seem to bore into us. She speaks in accented but grammatically perfect dragon tongue. It takes me a moment to realize she is reciting a poem. Though her coloring is pale like a storm scourge, she has the shrunken build, the accent, the unmistakable look of a peasant. But no peasant I've ever known could recite poetry in dragon tongue with such command. A chill goes down my spine. What are you? The words she recites, her face scrunched up in concentration. Come then, accept this offering. Give protection for my body. And with the dragon's grace, be my escort as I make my way to the shelter of the child's ancestral home. Her recitation means nothing for me, but when I look at Dilo, I realize it does for him. Tears have begun to course down his cheeks. Bring her to us, he rasps. The other Kallipolan rider, with a close-shaven head and skin as brown as Dilo's, has gone to his dragon and is undoing its load. And then, with slow and careful steps, he carries the swathed burden in both arms across the platform. He lays it between himself, the girl, and us. I kneel and part the folds of the shroud. Julia's helmet obscures most of her face, but I don't need to see more to know. Even though, since her disappearance, I feared this is how it would end, for a moment the sight of her colorless face doesn't register. Because how could this hurricane that I've been buffeted by for as long as I can remember, this protector and superior and commander and lover, how could it end like this? Still and small and motionless. More words are being exchanged between Dilo and the peasant girl, but they come distant, too distant to hear. As I lower my face to Julia's and feel how it has gone cold.
Annie. The shorter, stocky boy, whose storm scourge is the largest I've ever seen, kneels beside Julia, presses his face to hers, and begins to weep. Something about his gait, his manner, jars me like a stone out of place. The skyfish is tall, slender, with finely curling dark hair. He speaks with forced calm, though his face is wet.
Tell me what happened.
Julia made Leo choose a side. He chose. The skyfish's eyes widen. They dueled fairly. He asked that his cousin's body be returned to her people. At our feet, the storm scourge rider presses lips against Julia's eyes, nose, mouth. The sound of his sorrow strums through me.
Who are you?
The skyfish asks. My name is Antigone Sir Ayla. I take a breath, preparing to say it for the first time. First rider of the Kallipolin fleet. The crouching boy lifts his head to stare at me. The skyfish doesn't blink. He answers,
I am Dilo Sir Jaffira, Tertius.
He bows rigidly. It's the bow I've seen patricians give each other in formal introductions. A bow between equals. And though it's been 9 years since I was a Dragon Lord serf, it still feels like the earth has turned upside down to watch a dragonborn bow to me. I force myself to return the politeness as Dilo did it, lightly and from the neck, not the obeisance I was taught as a child.
You're not Tertius,
the crouching boy murmurs.
You're Alternus now, my lord.
Because Julia's position has opened, and the ranking has shifted. Dilo blanches. But what I hear is the address. Lord? What business has one of the Dragonborn addressing the other as Lord? Who are you? I ask the other boy. Dilo blinks, and his glance flits between us, as if it only now occurs to him that it is possible for me and the other boy to speak to each other. The other rises from where he crouches by Julia's side. Blue eyes blaze, set startlingly bright against an olive complexion, lined at the corners in a way that make his age hard to guess. Although I'd imagine he is the same age as Dilo, 2 or 3 years older than I.
Griff, he says. Griff Garrison.
No draconym. No ranking. And when Griff bows to me, he bows low. I look from Dilo to Griff, then back again, where Dilo wears heavy armor bearing the water lilies of Skyfish House, Griff is dressed only in a flame suit. And I do the math we should have done at that first sighting. There are known to be at least 20 dragons in the Pythian fleet, But of dragonborn children who survived the revolution, who were of an age to bond with dragons, there couldn't possibly have been so many.
My lord,
Griff says, dragging his arm across his wet face.
Should I take Lady Julia on Sparker?
Yes.
Thank you, Griff.
I hear the difference in addresses. Griff's formal you against Dilo's informal. And then I notice something else. Something I should have noticed from the start, but missed in the shadows of that great hulking storm scourge's horns. It's muzzled. I feel myself sway with horror. The Pythians have taken lowborn riders too. And the most unsettling thing of all, that when Griff lifts Julia's body into his arms, it's with the care and gentleness of something between a servant and something else. Something more. Power's hand grips my shoulder tightly.
We have company, he murmurs.
On the edge of the platform, a dark form rises up. A fifth dragon, another storm scourge, slithering over the edge as if it had come upon us from below. Slate grey, except its crest and tail, which are tipped with silver. This one's armour emblazoned with storm scourge heather. He takes off his helmet, and for a moment my breath stills because I see Lee. And then I shake my head, clearing it. Not Lee. This boy has the same dark hair against pale skin, the same grey eyes, the same build and gait. But there is a cruel edge to the lines of his face that are absent from Lee's. And he is, like Dilo, older. There's only one person this can be. Julia's brother, Ixion.
You should go,
Dilo tells us, as he turns to face the newcomer. Griff has frozen. His arms around Julia, and under Ixion's gaze, Griff shrinks. For a moment, Ixion stares at the body in Griff's arms. His shoulders tighten. The wind blows across Wayfarer's Arch, carrying silence. Then Ixion swings back around to face me. His lip curls as he looks me over, like he's just spotted something so offensive it turns his stomach.
You're that peasant bitch.
Griff flinches. And it's that flinch, not the words themselves, that ignites something inside me. I ball my fists and lift my chin. Yeah, I answer. I am. Griff's eyes go wide, as if I'd just shocked them open. I resist the urge to return his stare. Dilo takes Ixion's arm.
Antigone Sir Ayla will be granted safe passage back to her people, in accordance with the traditions of ours.
But Ixion shrugs him off, as if he hasn't heard him. He steps forward.
Maybe Leo lets you forget, but I won't. You're a Storm Scourge serf. I own you. And after this war, I will make sure you and all your stinking kind remember it.
Ayla's wings snap open behind me. I hear her growling like it comes from my own throat. Dilo moves to stand between us.
Enough.
No, not enough. Never enough. I feel as though the dragon were inside me, clawing its way from my gut. I feel a restraint and look down. Power has seized my arm.
Annie, he growls. We're outnumbered, and this isn't the mission.
Ixion lifts his bugle to his lips and blows. A piercing note splits the air, summoning other riders.
Annie, let's go.
Ayla and Eta charge to our sides, and we scramble onto their backs.
I'm only half on when Ayla kicks off from the ground, and I clamber the rest of the way into the saddle as the ground falls away. Ixion's Storm Scourge leaps as if to follow us, and Power Sir Eater spews fire down.
Come on, come on, faster!
Wayfarer's Arch falls away below us, but the Storm Scourge that launched after us is on our tails, and other dragons are appearing on the horizon, drawn to the sound of Ixion's bugle.
Make for the Stratus!
We rise, weaving, urging our dragons as fast as they can go. Ayla pommels the air with her wings. I abandon the reins to cling to her neck, flattening myself against her back and burying my helmet against her hot scales as the wind tears at us. Our dragons burst together through the cloud cover. It's so dense that Power Sir Eater disappears.
Annie! Here!
Lost in the white, we make our way south. In the silence and the cloud cover, my thoughts race. The sight of that muzzled dragon, of Griff Garrison's bowing, of Ixion's sneer, I own you. And like deeper notes of the same melody, earlier memories play in time, a symphony of anger. There. There. You've learned your lesson now, haven't you? I've learned my lesson. How many times do I need to keep learning it? When we finally dare to breach, Kallipolis is in sight again and the Pythians are gone. The sea turns to coast, and the coast turns to plains, and from those plains Pytho's keep rises, the city spread below it. I look down upon my island unseeing. Before, I thought of this war as something to withstand, an attack Kallipolis must defend against. But that was blinkered. This isn't a war to defend against. This is a war to win. Back in the palace, when we've dismounted and unsaddled our dragons at the mouth of the arena entrance to the caves, Power squints at me.
You all right?
No, I'm not all right. I'm pissed. I've spilled over, Ayla riding my emotions as she growls behind me. Power's face is suddenly glowing in the light of the fire she bellows upward. His eyes flick behind me, to her fire, then back at my face. There is something shining in his eyes as he looks at me now.